Send Me to Sleep is a production of Slumber Studios and is made possible thanks to the generous support of our sponsors and premium members. If you'd like to listen ad-free and have access to special bonus episodes, you can try out Premium Free for 7 days by following the link in the episode notes. Now, we'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors.
Sweeten your business purchases with American Express Blue Business Cash, the card that makes everyday expenses extra rewarding. You'll earn 2% cash back on your first $50,000 in purchases per year, and then 1% after that, so you can treat your bottom line and give your business a helpful boost. Swipe after swipe. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/bluebusinesscash. Amex Blue Business Cash. Built for business by American Express.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Send Me to Sleep, the place to find a good night's rest. My name's Andrew. Thanks for joining me, and for taking this time for yourself to ensure you get a peaceful night's sleep. Tonight, I'll be reading North and South by Elizabeth Gaskell, chapters 13 and 14. In the last chapters, Margaret had made a bad impression with Mrs. Thornton on her visit to the Hales. In these chapters, Mrs. Hale reveals some closely held secrets surrounding Margaret's absent brother, Frederick. If you haven't already, find a nice place to get cozy. Take a deep, relaxing breath. And settle your body in whatever way feels most comfortable. Now all you'll need to do is follow the sound of my voice. So let your eyes fall heavy and your breath soften as we settle in for a peaceful night's sleep. Chapter 13. Soft Breeze in a Sultry Place. That doubt and trouble, fear and pain, and anguish, all are shadows vain. That death itself shall not remain. That weary deserts we may tread, a dreary labyrinth may thread, through dark ways underground be led. Yet, if we will one guide obey, the dreariest path, the darkest way, shall issue out in heavenly day. And we, on divers, shores now cast, shall meet our perilous voyage past, all in our Father's house at last. R.C. Trench. Margaret flew upstairs as soon as their visitors were gone, and put on her bonnet and shawl to run and inquire how Betsy Higgins was, and sit with her as long as she could before dinner. As she went along the crowded, narrow streets, she felt how much of interest they had gained by the simple fact of her having learnt to care for a dweller in them. Mary Higgins, the slatterly young sister, had endeavoured as well as she could to tidy up the house for the expected visit. There had been rough stoning done in the middle of the floor, while the flags under the chairs and table and round the walls retained their dark, unwashed appearance. Although the day was hot, there burned a large fire in the grate, making the whole place feel like an oven. Margaret did not understand that the lavishness of coals was a sign of hospitable welcome to her on Mary's part, and thought that perhaps the oppressive heat was necessary for Bessie. Bessie herself lay on a squab, or sort of sofa, placed under the window. She was very much more feeble than on the previous day, and tired with raising herself at every step to look out and see if Margaret was coming, and had taken a chair by her. Bessie lay back silent and content to look at Margaret's face and touch her articles of dress with a childish admiration of their fineness of texture. "I never knew why folk in the Bible cared for soft raiment afore, but it must be nice to go dressed as you do. It's different fra common. Most fine folk tire my eyes out with their colours, but somehow yours rest me. Where did you get this frock?" "In London," said Margaret, much amused. "London. Have you been in London?" "Yes, I lived there for some years, but my home was in a forest in the country." "Tell me about it," said Bessie. "I like to hear speak of the country, and trees, and such like things." She leaned back and shut her eyes, and crossed her hands over her breast, lying at perfect rest, as if to receive all the ideas Margaret could suggest. Margaret had never spoken of Helston since she left it, except just naming the place incidentally. She saw it in dreams more vividly than life, and as she fell away to slumber at nights, her memory wandered in all its pleasant places. But her heart was opened to this girl. "Oh, Bessie, I loved the home we have left so dearly. I wish you could see it. I cannot tell you half its beauty. There are great trees standing all about it, with their branches stretching long and level, and making a deep shade of rest even at noonday. And yet, though every leaf may seem still, there is a continual rushing sound of movement all around, not close at hand. Then, sometimes, the turf is as soft and fine as velvet, and sometimes quite lush with the perpetual moisture of a little, hidden, tinkling brook near at hand. And then, in other parts, there are billowy ferns, whole stretches of fern, some in the green shadow, some with long streaks of golden sunlight lying on them, just like the sea." "I have never seen the sea," murmured Bessie. "But go on." "Then, here and there, There are wide commons, high up as if above the very tops of the trees. I am glad of that. I felt smothered like down below. When I have gone for an out, I've always wanted to get high up and see far away, and take a deep breath of fullness in that air. I get smothered enough in Milton, and I think the sound you speak of among the trees, going on forever and ever, would send me dazed. It's that made my head ache so in the mill. Now on these commons, I reckon, there is but little noise. No, said Margaret. Nothing but here and there a lark high in the sky. Sometimes I used to hear a farmer speaking sharp and loud to his servants, but it was so far away that it only reminded me pleasantly that other people were hard at work in some distant place, while I just sat on the heather and did nothing. I used to think once that if I could have a day of doing nothing, to rest me, a day in some quiet place like that you speak on, it would maybe set me up. But now I've had many days of idleness, and I'm just as weary of them as I was of my work. Sometimes I'm so tired out, I think I cannot enjoy heaven without a piece of rest first. I'm rather afraid of going straight there without getting a good sleep in the grave to set me up. Don't be afraid, Bessie, said Margaret, laying her hand on the girl's hand. God can give you more perfect rest than even idleness on earth, or the dead sleep of the grave can do. Bessie moved uneasily, and she said, I wish Father would not speak to me as he does. He means well, as I tell you yesterday, and tell you again and again. But you see, though I don't believe him a bit by day, yet by night, when I'm in a fever, half asleep and half awake, it comes back upon me. Oh, so bad. And I think, if this should be the end of all, and if all I've been born for is just to work my heart and my life away, and to sicken in this dreary place, with them mill noises in my ear forever, until I could scream out for them to stop, and let me have a little piece of quiet, and with a fluff filling my lungs, until I thirst to death for one long, deep breath on the clear air you speak on. And my mother gone, and I never able to tell her again how I loved her. And oh, all my troubles. I think if this life is the end, and there's no God to wipe away all tears from all eyes. You wench, you, said she, sitting up and clutching violently, almost fiercely, at Margaret's hand. I could go mad and kill you, I could. She fell back completely worn out with her passion. Margaret knelt down by her. Bessie, we have a Father in heaven. I know it, moaned she, turning her head uneasily from side to side. I'm very wicked. I've spoken very wickedly. Oh, don't be frightened by me, and never come again. I would not harm a hair of your head, and, opening her eyes and looking earnestly at Margaret, I believe perhaps, more than you do or what's to come. I read the books of Revelation until I know it off by heart, and I never doubt when I'm waking, and I'm in senses of the glory I'm to come to. Don't let us talk of what fancies come into your head when you are feverish. I would rather hear something about what you used to do when you were well. I think I were well when Mother died, but I've never been rightly strong since somewhere about that time. I began to work in a carding room soon after, and the fluff got into my lungs and poisoned me. Fluff? Said Margaret, inquiringly. Fluff, repeated Bessie. Little bits as flying off from cotton when they're carding it, and filling the air till it looks all fine white dust. They say it winds round the lungs, tightens them up. Anyhow, there's many a one as works in a carding room that falls into a waste, coughing and spitting blood, because they're just poisoned by the fluff. But can't it be helped? Asked Margaret. I dunno. Some folk have a great wheel at one end of their carding rooms to make a draught and carry off the dust. Well, that wheel costs a deal of money, 500 or 600 pounds maybe, and brings in no profit. So it's but a few of the masters as will put them up. And I've heard tell of men who didn't like working in places where there was a wheel, because they said as how it made them hungry, that after they'd been long used to swallowing fluff, to go on without it, and that their wages ought to be raised if they were to work in such a place. So between masters and men, the wheels have fallen through. I know I wished there'd been a wheel in our place, though.
Did not your father know about it? Asked Margaret.
Yes, and he was sorry. But our factory were a good one on the whole, and a steady likely set of people. And father was afraid of letting me go to a strange place, for though you wouldn't think it now, many a one then used to call me a gradely lass enough, and I didn't like to be reckoned nesh and soft, and Mary's schooling were to be kept up, mother said, and father, he were always liking to buy books and go to lectures of one kind and another, all which took money, so I just worked on till I shall never get the whir out of me ears, or the fluff out of my throat in this world. That's all.
How old are you? Asked Margaret.
19, come July. And I too am 19.
She thought more sorrowfully than Bessie did of the contrast between them. She could not speak for a moment or two, for the emotion she was trying to keep down.
About Mary, said Bessie. I want to ask you to be a friend to her. She's 17, but she's the last on us, and I don't want her to go to the mill, and yet I don't know what she's fit for.
She could not do. Margaret glanced unconsciously at the uncleaned corners of the room. She could hardly undertake a servant's place, could she? We have an old faithful servant, almost a friend, who wants help, but who is very particular, and it would not be right to plague her with giving any assistance that would really be an annoyance and an irritation.
No, I see. I reckon you're right. Our Mary's a good wench, but who has she had to teach her what to do about an house? No mother, and me at the mill till I was good for nothing but scolding her for doing badly what I didn't know how to do a bit. But I wished she could have lived with you, for all that. But even though she may not be exactly fitted to come and live with us as a servant, and I don't know about that, I will always try to be a friend to her for your sake, Bessie. And now I must go. I will come again as soon as I can, but if it should not be tomorrow, or the next day, or even a week or a fortnight hence, don't think I've forgotten you. I may be busy. I'll know you won't forget me again. I'll not mistrust you no more. But remember, in a week or a fortnight, I might be dead and buried. I'll come again as soon as I can, Bessie, said Margaret, squeezing her hand tight. But you'll let me know if you get worse. Aye, that will I, said Bessie, returning the pressure. From that day forward, Mrs. Hale became more and more of a suffering individual. It was now drawing near to the anniversary of Edith's marriage, and looking back upon the year's accumulated heap of troubles, Margaret wondered how they had been borne. If she could have anticipated them, how she would have shrunk away and hid herself from the coming time. And yet, day by day had, of itself, and by itself, been very endurable. Small, keen, bright little spots of positive enjoyment having come sparkling into the very middle of sorrows. A year ago, or when she first went to Helston, and first became silently conscious of the querulousness in her mother's temper, she would have groaned bitterly over the idea of a long illness to be born in a strange, desolate, noisy, busy place, with diminished comforts on every side of the home life. But with the increase of serious and just ground of complaint, a new kind of patience had sprung up in her mother's mind. She was gentle and quiet in intense bodily suffering, almost in proportion as she had been restless and depressed when there had been no real cause for grief. Mr. Hale was in exactly that stage of apprehension which, in men of his stamp, takes the shape of willful blindness. He was more irritated than Margaret had ever known him at his daughter's expressed anxiety. Indeed, Margaret, you are growing fanciful. God knows I should be the first to take the alarm if your mother were really ill. We always saw when she had her headaches at Helston, even without her telling us. She looks quite pale and white when she is ill, and now she has a bright, healthy colour in her cheeks, just as she used to have when I first met her. But Papa, said Margaret with hesitation, do you know I think that it is a flush of pain? Nonsense, Margaret. I tell you, you are too fanciful. You are the person not well, I think. Send for the doctor tomorrow for yourself, and then, if it will make your mind easier, he can see your mother.
Thank you, dear Papa. It will make me happier indeed. And she went up to kiss him, but he pushed her away, gently enough, but still as if she had suggested unpleasant ideas, which he should be glad to get rid of as readily as he could of her presence. He walked uneasily up and down the room. "Poor Maria," said he, half soliloquizing. "I wish one could do right without sacrificing others. I shall hate this town, and myself too, if she... Pray, Margaret, does your mother often talk to you of the old places? Of Helston, I mean." "No, Papa," said Margaret, sadly. "Then, you see, she can't be fretting after them, eh? It has always been a comfort to me to think that your mother was so simple and open that I knew every little grievance she had. She never would conceal anything seriously affecting her health from me, would she, eh, Margaret? I'm quite sure she would not. So, don't let me hear of these foolish, morbid ideas. Come, give me a kiss, and run off to bed." But she heard him pacing about, racooning, as she and Edith used to call it, long after her slow and languid undressing was finished. Long after she had begun to listen as she lay in bed. Chapter 14. The Meeting. I was used to sleep at nights as sweetly as a child. Now, if the wind blew rough, it made me start and think of my poor boy tossing about upon the roaring seas. And then I seemed to feel that it was hard to take him from me for such a little fault. Southey. It was a comfort to Margaret about this time to find that her mother drew more tenderly and intimately towards her than she had ever done since the days of her childhood. She took her to her heart as a confidential friend, the post Margaret had always longed to fill, and had envied Dixon for being preferred to. Margaret took pains to respond to every call made upon her for sympathy, and they were many, even when they related to trifles which she would no more have noticed or regarded herself than the elephant would have perceived the little pin at his feet, which yet he lifts carefully up at the bidding of his keeper. All unconsciously, Margaret drew near to a reward. One evening, Mr. Hale being absent, her mother began to talk to her about her brother, Frederick, the very subject on which Margaret had longed to ask questions, and almost the only one on which her timidity overcame her natural openness. The more she wanted to hear about him, the less likely she was to speak. "Oh, Margaret, it was so windy last night. It came howling down the chimney in our room. I could not sleep. I never can when there is such a terrible wind. I got into a wakeful habit when poor Frederick was at sea. And now, even if I don't waken all at once, I dream of him in some stormy sea, with great, clear, glass-green walls of waves on either side his ship, but far higher than her very masts, curling over her with that cruel, terrible white foam, like some gigantic crested serpent. It is an old dream, but it will always come back on windy nights, till I am thankful to waken, sitting straight and stiff up in bed with my terror. Poor Frederick. He is on land now, so wind can do him no harm. Though I did think it might shake down some of those tall chimneys. Where is Frederick now, Mama? Our letters are directed to the care of Monsieur Barber at Cadiz, I know. But where is he himself? I can't remember the name of the place. But he is not called Hale. You must remember that, Margaret. Notice the FD in every corner of the letters. He has taken the name of Dickinson. I wanted him to have been called Beresford, to which he has a kind of right. But your father thought he'd better not. He might be recognised, you know, if he were to be called by my name. Mama, said Margaret. I was at Aunt Shaw's when this all happened, and I suppose I was not old enough to be told plainly about it. But I should like to know now, if I may, if it does not give you too much pain to speak about it. Pain? No, replied Mrs. Hale, her cheeks flushing. Yet, it is pain to think that perhaps I may never see my darling boy again. Or else he did right, Margaret. They may say what they like, but I have his own letters to show, and I'll believe him, though he is my son, sooner than any court martial on earth. Go to my little Japan cabinet, dear, and in the second left-hand drawer you will find a packet of letters. Margaret went. There were the yellow, sea-stained letters, with the peculiar fragrance which ocean letters have. Margaret carried them back to her mother, who untied the silken string with trembling fingers, and, examining their dates, she gave them to Margaret to read, making her hurried, anxious remarks on their contents, almost before her daughter could have understood what they were. You see, Margaret, how from the very first he disliked Captain Reed. He was second lieutenant in the ship, the Orion, in which Frederick sailed the very first time. Poor little fellow. How well he looked in his midshipman's dress, with his dirk in his hand, cutting open all the newspapers with it as if it were a paper knife. But this Mr. Reed, as he was then, seemed to take a dislike to Frederick from the very beginning. And then, stay, these are the letters he wrote on board the Russell. When he was appointed to her, and found his old enemy Captain Reed in command, he did mean to bear all his tyranny patiently. Look, this is the letter. Just read it, Margaret. Where is it, he says. Stop. My father may rely upon me, that I will bear with all proper patience everything that an officer and gentleman can take from another. But from my former knowledge of my present captain, I confess I look forward with apprehension to a long course of tyranny on board the Russell. You see, he promises to bear patiently, and I am sure he did, for he was the sweetest-tempered boy when he was not vexed. That could possibly be. Is that the letter in which he speaks of Captain Reed's impatience with the men for not going through the ship's manoeuvres as quickly as the Avenger? You see, he says that they had many new hands on board the Russell, while the Avenger had been nearly 3 years on the station, with nothing to do but to keep slavers off and work her men, till they ran up and down the rigging like rats or monkeys. Margaret slowly read the letter, half illegible through the fading of the ink. It might be, it probably was, a statement of Captain Reed's imperiousness in trifles, very much exaggerated by the narrator, who had written it while fresh and warm from the scene of the altercation. Some sailors being aloft in the main topsail rigging, the captain had ordered them to race down, threatening the hindmost with the cat of nine tails. He who was the farthest on the spar, feeling the impossibility of passing his companions, and yet passionately dreading the disgrace of the flogging, threw himself desperately down to catch a rope considerably lower, failed, and fell senselessly on the deck. He only survived for a few hours afterwards, and the indignation of the ship's crew was at boiling point when young Hale wrote. But we did not receive this letter till long, long after we heard of the mutiny. Poor Fred. I dare say it was a comfort to him to write it, even though he could not have known how to send it, poor fellow. And then we saw a report in the papers, that's to say, long before Fred's letter reached us, of an atrocious mutiny having broken out on board the Russell, and that the mutineers had remained in possession of the ship, which had gone off, it was supposed, to be a pirate, and that Captain Reed was sent adrift in a boat with some men, officers or something, whose names were all given, for they were picked up by a West Indian steamer. Oh, Margaret, how your father and I turned sick over that list, when there was no name of Frederick Hale. We thought it must be some mistake, for poor Fred was such a fine fellow, only perhaps rather too passionate, and we hoped that the name of Carr, which was in the list, was a misprint for that of Hale. Newspapers are so careless. And towards post time the next day, Papa set off to walk to Southampton to get the papers, and I could not stop at home, so I went to meet him. He was very late, much later than I thought he would have been, and I sat down under the hedge to wait for him. He came at last, his arms hanging loose down, his head sunk, and walking heavily along, as if every step was a labour and a trouble. Margaret, I see him now. Don't go on, Mama. I can understand it all, said Margaret, leaning up caressingly against her mother's side and kissing her hand. No, You can't, Margaret. No one can who did not see him then. I could hardly lift myself up to go and meet him. Everything seemed so to reel around me all at once. And when I got to him, he did not speak or seem surprised to see me there, more than 3 miles from home, besides the Oldman beech tree. But he put my arm in his and kept stroking my hand, as if he wanted to soothe me to be very quiet under some great, heavy blow. And when I trembled so all over that I could not speak, he took me in his arms and stooped down his head on mine and began to shake and to cry in a strange, muffled, groaning voice, till I, for very fright, stood quite still, and only begging him to tell me what he had heard. And then, with his hand jerking, as if someone else moved it against his will, he gave me the wicked newspaper to read, calling our Frederick a traitor of the blackest dye, a base, ungrateful disgrace to his profession. Oh, I cannot tell what bad words they did not use. I took the paper in my hands as soon as I had read it. I tore it up into little bits. I tore it. I believe, Margaret, I tore it with my teeth. I did not cry. I could not. My cheeks were as hot as fire, and my very eyes burnt in my head. I saw your father looking grave at me. I said it was a lie, and so it was. Months after, this letter came, and you see what provocation Frederick had. It was not for himself or his own injuries he rebelled, but he would speak his mind to Captain Reed, and so it went on from bad to worse. And you see, most of the sailors stuck by Frederick. I think, Margaret, she continued, after a pause, in a weak, trembling, exhausted voice, I am glad of it. I am prouder of Frederick standing up against injustice than if he had simply been a good officer. I am sure I am, said Margaret, in a firm, decided tone. Loyalty and obedience to wisdom and justice are fine, but it is still finer to defy arbitrary power, unjustly and cruelly used, not on behalf of ourselves, but on behalf of others more helpless. For all that, I wish I could see Frederick once more, just once. He was my first baby, Margaret. Mrs. Hale spoke wistfully, and almost as if apologizing for the yearning, craving wish, as though it were a deprecation of her remaining child. But such an idea never crossed Margaret's mind. She was thinking how her mother's desire could be fulfilled. It is 6 or 7 years ago. Would they still prosecute him, Mother? If he came and stood his trial, what would be the punishment? Surely he might bring evidence of his great provocation. It would do no good, replied Mrs. Hale. Some of the sailors who accompanied Frederick were taken, and there was a court-martial held on them on board the Amica. I believe all they said in their defence, poor fellows, because it just agreed with Frederick's story. But it was of no use. And for the first time during the conversation, Mrs. Hale began to cry. Yet something possessed Margaret to force the information she foresaw, yet dreaded, from her mother. "What happened to them, Mama?" asked she. "They were hung at the yardarm," said Mrs. Hale, solemnly. "And the worst was that the court, in condemning them to death, said they had suffered themselves to be led astray from their duty by their superior officers." They were silent for a long time. "And Frederick was in South America for several years, was he not?" "Yes, and now he is in Spain, at Cadiz, or somewhere near it. If he comes to England, he will be hung. I shall never see his face again, for if he comes to England, he will be hung." There was no comfort to be given. Mrs. Hale turned her face to the wall and lay perfectly still in her mother's despair. Nothing could be said to console her. She took her hand out of Margaret's with a little impatient movement, as if she would fain be left alone with the recollection of her son. When Mr. Hale came in, Margaret went out, oppressed with gloom, and seeing no promise of brightness on any side of the horizon.